In the new hit movie, Julie and Julia, Meryl Streep brings Julia Child, that grand dame of French cooking, vividly to life on screen. Since Julia Child's death in 2004, she has become even more popular than when she was alive with the American public. We can't seem to get enough of her television reruns, and we keep trying to master the art of French cooking, one roasted guinea hen at a time. What endeared Julia Child to so many millions of people was not beauty or brains, not even skill in the kitchen, of which she had a considerable amount. No, what we adored about her more than anything else were her misadventures in the kitchen. The most memorable being what she called her potato show. Now, over the years, she had dropped many a goose or roast on the floor during the course of a television cooking program. But this mishap was in a league of its own. She was making a plate-sized potato pancake, sautéing a disc of mashed potatoes into which she had folded a considerable amount of cream and butter. Then the fateful moment arrived. She said, "When you flip anything, you have to have the courage of your convictions." And then she gave the pancake a flip. It did fine on the way up, but on the way down, it caught the lip of the pan and it splatted all over the stovetop. Undaunted, she picked it all up, patched it back together, and explained, "You see, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it as I should have." And then she leaned toward the camera and took her audience into her confidence, freeing them forever from fear of failure. She said, "If you are alone in your kitchen, who's to see?" Thinking about the splatted pancake, I thought of potato. I thought today we would tackle the tough topic of imperfection. I could take on perfection, but since neither you nor I appear to be in danger of achieving it anytime soon, I decided that facing our imperfections might be a more useful approach. The Bible goes to great lengths to remind us of the imperfect state of our being. "All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God," Paul lamented in his letter to the Romans. "Woe is me, I am lost, I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips." These were the words that Isaiah spoke in his despair. The human heart is devious above all else. It is so perverse, who can understand it? That is Jeremiah inquiring rhetorically. I won't go on, but you get the drift. Yes, Jesus does say in the Sermon on the Mount, "Be perfect, therefore, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." But you have to understand the context of that particular saying. Jesus is speaking of God's love and its completeness. And he is suggesting that we love in a way analogous to the way God loves. We tend to love only our friends and to dislike, disrespect, sometimes hate our enemies. But we ought not to love that way. We ought to love indiscriminately as God does. Perfect in the Sermon on the Mount means full and all-encompassing, imitating God's life-giving mercy, which is offered to all without qualification. Perfection, then, in the sense of getting everything right, in the sense of being without flaw or blemish, is a characteristic of God and of God's own Son and of God's own Spirit and of no one else ever. This does not stop some of us from continuing to try to achieve perfection. And in the course of trying, we can make those around us miserable as well as ourselves. I found an article I'd clipped maybe 20 years ago written by a psychiatrist named Dr. David Burns. He had studied the particular human tendency toward perfectionism. He wrote, "Those who suffer from perfectionism feel as if they will be perfect failures if they fall short of their expectations of themselves." He tells of lecturing one day to a group of insurance agents on the pitfalls of perfectionist thinking. The salesman in the audience nodded in agreement and applauded heartily when he was finished. Next, the president of the insurance company stood up. He went to the podium and he began his speech by saying, "People, we are number two this year. That is not good enough. Being number one, that's all that counts. And don't you forget it." Anna Quinlan, writing about her perfectionism, called it a sack of bricks that she carried around all her life until she finally found the courage to lay it down. The result, each day, she writes, each day became light as a feather. Perfectionism is simply not achievable for human beings. And when we come to accept that as a fact of life, we can get on with the business of living as God would have us live and loving as God would have us love. This is not to say that we should not try to be the best that we can be, to strive for excellence, but there is a difference between excellence and perfection. Perfection never lets you go. Perfection is the most jealous mistress there is. Well, there was nothing perfect about Jeremiah the prophet. He was crusty, ill-tempered, cranky with God, cranky with the people. He was convinced, as was the Lord, that Israel had done nothing right, was stubbornly idolatrous, had decided to follow their own plans and act according to their own wills. Jeremiah was actually ready to give up on them, but the Lord was not ready to give up. He instructed Jeremiah to go down to the potter's house where the Lord would speak to him there. The vessel that the potter was making at the wheel when Jeremiah arrived, the vessel had become spoiled in the potter's hand. And as Jeremiah watched, the potter purposefully splatted the clay, gathered it all up, and then splatted it back down on the wheel again so that he could rework the clay into another vessel as seemed good to him. And the Lord said, "Just like the clay in the potter's hand, so you are in my hand, O house of Israel." Let's think about the pot that failed for a minute. Note that the potter had no need to alter the substance with which he was working. The substance was fine and good. The clayness of the clay was just right. The problem was that what was inherently good had become misshapen. The flawed vessel had to be collapsed in order for the potter to begin again. That was Israel. By inference, it's us too. To be honest, my heart does not soar at the thought of myself as a lump of clay, especially a lump of clay that needs to be reworked and reworked and reworked. No, it bothers me a little bit. It hurts my ego, but I have come to believe that this particular story is one of the most hopeful stories that the scriptures tell. Because I think there is deep down in all of us, a desire to be made new again. I cannot tell you the number of days that I have gotten up in the morning with a whole set of resolutions that have been broken by noon. I'm going to eat a more healthful breakfast. Yes, I'm going to walk a mile and a half. And of course, I'm going to read the book that I've been putting off, and I'm going to be sweeter to everybody I live and work with. And by the middle of the day, I'm the same old Joanna who'd gotten up that morning. I think there's not much hope for any of us without divine intervention. Human will is not enough. Our church is a religious body founded in the Reformed tradition. Our founder, John Calvin, whose 500th birthday we celebrate this year, loved to talk about what he called the teachable spirit. This phrase, coined by Calvin, is based on an awareness of human sin and finitude, and the need for individual Christians to be dependent upon an objective means of grace. And where do you find that? You find it in the church and in the story we tell here of Jesus and his saving love. Today, as we begin a new year in Christian education, we remember how important it is that children and young people grow up knowing and loving and trusting God. A few years ago, the Lilly Foundation conducted a survey that measured how people came to faith, how they attain a degree of spiritual maturity. Two factors more than any others, were formative. The first, the attitude the family had toward religion during the person's formative years, from 5 years old to 12 years old. And the second, very simple, exposure to Christian education. This is not rocket science here. I love the thought of the church as the potter's house. I love to think of it as the place where God is working at God's divine wheel, forming us, reshaping us, fixing those parts of us that somehow have gotten messed up along the way. God's not trying to make you a perfect person. God is after your cooperation. If God had to depend on perfect people to do the work of the kingdom, God would come up short in every generation. But God perseveres using what there is to work with. For years, I've kept in my files a column by Sam Matthews, one of the best preachers and pastors in the United Methodist tradition. He starts this column by listing eras baseball players had made in recent weeks, various Atlanta Braves pitchers and catchers and first basemen, and he says, if I were the team manager, I would have pulled that errant first baseman, that weary pitcher who gave up too many runs. And then he goes on, but then if I were God, I would have pulled Abraham 2 or 3 times. I would have pulled Moses when he lost his temper. I would have pulled David when he lost his moral compass. I would have pulled each of the disciples at one time or another, especially Peter, James, and John. I would have pulled Saul of Tarsus before he ever heard of the Damascus Road. But then again, I'm neither coach nor God. And I've come to see that most of God's work is done by leaky vessels, by people who sometimes lose their way. A Christian group once passed out lapel pins imprinted with these letters, this acronym, PBPGINFWMY. Chris asked me if this was peanut butter and gin, and I told him no. The letters stand for, please be patient. God is not finished with me yet. Paul writes, we have this treasure that is the gospel in clay jars, so it is very clear that it's not we who are extraordinary. This extraordinary power belongs to God. The King James uses the words earthen vessels, but that's way too fancy. Clay jars does it better. Clay jars are ordinary, cheap, subject to flaw and breakage, leakage and seepage, just as Paul and I and you are. Our strengths lie in the transcendent power of God at work in us, sometimes through us, sometimes in spite of us. A friend recently sent me something entitled The Best Poem in the World. I was shocked, confused, bewildered as I entered heaven's door, not by the beauty of it all, nor the lights, nor its decor. No, it was the people in heaven who made me sputter and gasp. The thieves, the liars, the sinners, the alcoholics, and the trash. There stood that kid from 7th grade who stole my lunch money twice. Next to him was our old neighbor, who never had said anything nice. Herb, who I always thought was surely rotting away in hell, was sitting right there on cloud 9, looking very well. I nudged Jesus. What's the deal? I would love to hear your take. How did all these sinners get up here? God must have made a mistake. And why is everyone so quiet, so somber? Give me a clue. Hush, child, our Lord said. They're all in shock. No one thought they'd be seeing you. I've spoken today about our personal imperfections. I recently read that over the next 4 decades, 3 billion people will be living on this planet, in addition to the number of people who are already here. In other words, the population will increase by 3 billion. The world will need to double its food production and increase market efficiency. I know this seems perhaps off subject, but it's not just us we need to be thinking about. We've got to change the way we do things as a human society. And we can do it. God can create in us a larger heart and a wiser mind. There is no reason in the world why millions of people should be hungry today, when we have the capacity to do something about it. God was frustrated not with an individual person in the story of the potter's house. God was frustrated with a whole nation that had lost its moral compass. And you can say that God must be frustrated with the world, which seems to love war more than peace. Again and again, I come back to something Yale Divinity School professor Margaret Farley once wrote about the meaning of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. She wrote, "Whatever else the Christian faith has stood for across the centuries, it has always maintained that what has been does not necessarily determine what will be." Another way to put it, please be patient. God is not finished with us yet. Please, let us offer ourselves to God who wants to make us new and whole again. A quick story as I close. In a church in another city, a new Sunday school year began one fall. Among the offerings for adults was a class entitled Spiritual Formation. After the class had been going for several weeks, a woman in the church asked the teacher if it were all right if she joined the class. And the teacher said, "Well, of course, it's fine. Why would you ask?" And the woman answered, "Well, I am 94 years old. And I just wondered if it were too late for me to take a class on spiritual formation." I don't believe it's ever too late for God to get His hands on us and to help us become what God intended us to be all along. Thanks be to God.